Welcome to another episode of A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. We'll be talking to Jonathan Finlayson, great trumpet player, inspiring composer, Pi Recordings artist, and this is the first episode we've done in a little while. You're welcome to email us at podcast@greenleafmusic.com and come say hello, come subscribe. Greenleafmusic.com has all the information, and we're going to get into the music now. So thanks for listening. Jonathan Finlayson, thanks for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure to be here.
And so this Pi Recordings record that I was just excerpting is your first record as a leader, really?
First, yeah, absolutely. First record as a leader.
First among many, I hope.
Hopefully so.
So this tune that we were listening to is called Low Haze, and man, it's hard to talk about the music, but the first... Well, I mean, it seems like the piece is in two big parts. Like there's two main theme areas. It's like cut right in the middle, and then there's a new thing that happens.
Right. That's true. There's the middle part I like to consider the glue or the binding between the A and the C section, I guess.
Hmm. And how did you develop the material?
The first section, I developed, I do a lot of writing on the piano.
Uh-huh.
So I try to start very simply. And it started out as what you hear first, actually, which is the dialogue between the bass and the piano.
Mm.
And once I was satisfied with, you know, how the duration and how they play together, then I started to fill it out.
When you say fill it out, you mean like other melodic parts or harmonies?
Well, everything actually. So at first it was these two voices just kind of going, and then I knew there was an implied harmony. So I sat down and I figured out what that was.
Mm.
So that kind of let me know that there was let me know where the key center was. Which I guess is roughly around A flat minor.
Roughly speaking, sure.
Roughly speaking, yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, do you use chord symbols on the charts?
Of course.
You do?
I do. I do, but it depends upon who's doing what.
Mm.
So I like to give voicings a lot of the times. And then kind of deduce, like I'll give the voicings and then we'll sit down and I'll say this is in the area of such and such. Or sometimes it's very explicit, like it's a triad and then there's no
question.
Ambiguity about it.
Huh. So do you feel like you go through that process because the musicians in the band need to know that information, or is it more just a collective process of finding out what's there?
I feel both ways about that. I feel like they should know. There's another song on the album that doesn't have traditional chords. It's the last track entitled "Sand Gates."
I think I'm going to play some of that later on.
So that's built on that's just a series of dyads,
mm-hmm.
mainly seconds, and then I think there's like a major third somewhere in mm-hmm. one instance. But I was going to say that it's part of the discovery, I guess, is I like that part. And showing it to them, it's like teaching somebody something. You, in turn, learn more about, you know, what you've done. You know, it more becomes clear.
Mm.
So that part's great. And then, you know, being on the same page with everybody, but then also letting them know that, you know, if you've got something else you want to do, that's all right, too.
Specific in the way everybody in the band dialogues with the material it just seems like it's really in a pocket. Like there's been a decision made about what this is.
Sure.
And you're going from there. And then you must have some instructions about how you want the improvisation to work, because it seems like people are always coming and going. And there's trading, and there's not like the traditional main soloist.
Right. That's true. There's a song, I think the song composition of Ry Lopez mm-hmm. has a very specific kind of strategy for how you negotiate the improvisation sections. But then other songs, you know, I mean, we're making an album, so it's great to have some instructions for how long and the durations people are supposed to play. But in a performance, it would be totally different.
Thank you.
definitely have a say in that. But it's more about me communicating to them the idea behind how I want the narrative of the piece to go.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'll tell them this section is a build-up, or it's supposed to be kind of a question to the answer that is this section, to the statement that is this section, etc. So you use any kind of analogy that you can to communicate the idea. And luckily, there are people that, you know, vibrate sympathetically, so they're in tune with you in that regard. So they have no problem communicating the idea as well, or understanding it.
And do you think about the way that improvising works, like trading? It's like, is that spelled out? It seems like there's a lot of coming and going. It's not like...
What do you mean, the trading? Like,
well, it seems like, you know, one person will play two or three bars, and then the other person will play two or three bars, and there's like coming and going, you know, back and forth. Happens a lot in several of the pieces on the record, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Ruy Lopez works that way too.
Yeah, that's actually like structurally that has, it's built to mirror a chess game. So what you hear is, it's a longer explanation, but what you're hearing is when one person plays, they're in the space where the white pieces are, and then the next place is the space where the black pieces, and it's white, so you're alternating, so it's supposed to be like a game. So the dialogue you hear is in the spaces of a game.
Okay, so I'm going to play that now.
Okay.
Now that I have that clear in my head, I'm going to listen to Ruy Lopez. So the whole piece is like a rundown of a chess match where different people are representing different squares, color squares, but also pieces?
Well, they're just representing different moves. And the piece is based off of the opening, which is Ruy Lopez.
The Ruy Lopez opening.
Right. So I think it's the first 12 moves of the opening before you get out of the opening.
And we're talking about chess.
We're talking about chess now. So there's 12 moves. I think it's 12 somewhere along that line where it's kind of like the responses are very well known, like very well known play. And then you go from that into the middle game, basically. But what we're hearing when we improvise, what you're hearing when you hear the improvisation in those spaces between the guitar and the trumpet and then the piano and the bass are those spaces. So I mapped out I mapped out the 8 squares.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And I gave every piece a function.
A musical function.
I gave them a
or an interval.
I gave them values in terms of harmony. So.
Okay.
The easiest way I can explain it is that the king is a C and the queen is a C.
Mm-hmm.
But the king is a C major and the queen is a C minor. Mm-hmm. And then the queen's pieces all have minor functions and the king's pieces all have minor
major functions.
Uh-huh. Okay. And then when one piece traverses from one square to another, that is, it's a certain type of movement. And then from that square to another, it's a certain type of movement.
Melodic movement, you mean, or harmonic movement.
Harmonic movement.
Uh-huh.
So what you're hearing is the harmonic movements of these pieces moving.
We create the
melodic
movements. When we hear melodic and harmonic movement that feels like it's moving in a minor key direction, that's on the queen's side.
That's either... Whenever you hear a minor chord, it's either a piece coming from one side of the board and landing on another, or a piece originating on one side of the board and then landing on another. So you hear these groupings of these different combinations of majors and minor sixes, etc. You know.
Okay, I'm going to play a little bit more of this, like from Drop the Needle somewhere in the middle of the piece.
Okay.
That's great. Now for 2 years.
I have.
And you tell me you're working on another record for them.
I am.
So I reached out and said, what should I ask Jonathan? And Lynn told me you should ask him about how he met Steve Coleman.
Oh man. So I have, there's about 3 meetings I had with Steve Coleman when I was younger. I just came from doing a residency in LA, and they're still there. But when I think I was 13 years old, I did the Stanford Jazz Workshop, and Steve Coleman and 5 Elements, or Metrics, I believe it was, the hip-hop artist, they were in residence in Oakland, and they were doing a week at Stanford. So I remember sitting in on a workshop. You know, there was like about 100 kids in there, but it was really over my head. You know, mm-hmm. I had no idea what he was talking about. And I met him maybe like once mm-hmm. during that week at Stanford. And while he was there, he was playing at a place called the Upper Room. It's a bygone establishment mm-hmm. in Oakland. I told my mom I wanted to go. She dropped me off. I went upstairs, I sat, I watched this concert, mm-hmm. and it was it was really heavy. Like, I guess what I was listening to at the time was really nothing like it, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Move forward. Cut a couple of years. Jessica Jones.
I remember her, sure.
She took Ambrose and I and a couple of other kids to a workshop.
That's right, because she used to live in New York, but then she...
She used to live in Berkeley, and now she lives in New York.
Okay.
But she was really into the music of Steve, uh-huh. and she called me one day when I was at home, you know, still had to get permission from my mother.
Right.
And she said, is Jonathan available? I'd like to take him to this Steve Coleman rehearsal. You know, I'm trying to get a bunch of kids to go and see it. So, mm-hmm. you know, I was 14, 13. And we go to this rehearsal, and I think Ralph was there. You know, I have these, like, very vague memories of the rehearsal.
Right.
Again, not understanding.
This was probably Five Elements, or?
I think this was Five Elements. Honestly, I don't even remember. I just remember the room. Uh-huh. Kind of, and like Steve laughing and, mm-hmm. and playing, and like the music was very complicated. But okay, we'll go fast forward to, I guess, when I met him as almost an adult. Mm-hmm. He came to my high school and mm-hmm. he did a workshop at Berkeley High School mm-hmm. back when he was teaching at UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, I guess, when I met him and, you know, a little bit older, could have more of a conversation, I guess. Mm-hmm. But over the years, I think I met him a couple times between 13 and 17.
And then when did he call you to be in the band?
Let's see.
It's a long time now, right?
Yeah.
I'm playing with Steve.
Not that long after I met him in high school, I think.
Wow. So he was still calling your mom to get permission for you to come out on the road when you
yeah,
joined the band.
Landline, you know. it would be Sophia.
Uh-huh, right.
And I didn't even have, I don't think I had my own email address, so she like emailed my dad. But
that's great. So would you, I mean, Steve, obviously he's been a formative influence for so many people.
Sure.
And I'm sure he's been really important for you.
Absolutely.
In terms of so many of the musical elements.
And it goes on and on.
Do you find that? Well, I mean, I guess you find everything that happens to you in your work, right? But mm-hmm. I mean, when you're writing, you think about stuff that you hear Steve talking about. Or?
At this point, if it happens, it's not.
Not
a conscious kind of thing, you know.
Because like when I heard, can you say the name of that song?
Sayin' Gates.
Sayin' Gates.
Yeah.
bit of say in Gates, and I'm hearing that trumpet solo and I'm thinking, boy, trumpet heroes.
Oh man.
I hear a lot of influences and a lot of people. I hear Jonathan, you know, at the root of it, but like anybody, right, we all have heroes.
We have a bunch of heroes.
Do you name check anybody in particular?
Oh man, there's so many people. Let's get the big ones out the way, like Miles and Freddie Hubbard.
Miles, who's Miles, this Miles?
Miles. Miles Davis, you know, Freddie Hubbard, Woody Shaw.
Right.
I love Dizzy, Fats Navarro, Clifford Brown.
So it's all coming from all of this.
Yeah,
that we all listen to.
I love all these guys, and you know, I even like Doc Severinsen, and you know.
And you went to the New School, so you must have studied with Jimmy Owens and Cecil Bridgewater and Eddie Henderson. And
I got to meet those guys.
And Laurie Frink.
I studied with Laurie for a little bit.
Yeah, uh-huh.
I had some great lessons with Laurie, Eddie. Jimmy, Cecil, yeah. Charles Tolliver, did a lesson with Charles.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. So what's your next move as a band leader?
I want to record this next album.
For Pi Recording?
For Pi Recording.
Well, they'll be relieved to know that you're working on that. That's what that one thing they asked me to ask you, you know, when is he going
to... Definitely want to work on that. And then I have some other music... for a slightly larger group, I'd like to record. You know, but aside from that, you know, keep trying to practice.
You're playing in so many different contexts now, too. I mean, Steve,
that's
but
true.
Also Mary Halverson and
that's true.
Other
Steve Lehman.
Steve Lehman, right?
Yeah, there's that too.
Keeps you busy, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
It's good.
Yes, it does.
It's good. So we're the new band, is Miles Okazaki still playing with you?
Miles is still gonna play, absolutely. Uh-huh. You wanna know everybody.
Do you have a person you don't have to tell, you don't have to divulge?
I'm not gonna divulge.
It's trade secrets.
Trade secrets.
All right. Thanks for talking with me.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it. I'm sorry there was some noise in the background.
It's okay. It feels really real, you know.
It's totally real. We're crammed in this little room here.
We are in
New School. But it's great hearing the music and talking to you, and it's always inspiring to see what you're doing and see you out there.
Hey, thank you, Dave.
Right. Thank you. while that music was playing, we were like shop talking out, and Jonathan told me that he just got this Mount Vernon Bach, which is very beautiful, and he just showed it to me, and it's incredible. And if you're not a trumpet player, you have no idea what we're talking about, but it's like a really great old horn that is a vintage horn that he found at Josh Landris's shop.
Very true.
And then I asked him if is that what he was playing on this record, and it turned out that it wasn't. He's playing something on the record that's much closer to what I play, actually.
Oh, okay. So what do you play, Dave?
Well, you tell me first.
Well, on the record, I'm playing a, it's a Strad, but it's a 25 Bach.
So a Bach
Stradivarius. It's got a large bore, yeah.
Large bore.
Yeah.
25 Bell.
That's the model, 25, I guess.
Yeah. I think that's what I play. You know what? This is showing the limits of our geekery. I'm actually opening up my horn case just to make sure. But yeah, I play a large bore 25.
Oh, man. Okay.
I've been playing forever.
Good horn.
This is my third one, actually. They have two, like, destroyed ones that are still in the closet. One other trumpet geek thing that I feel we should cover is just that you started on a Martin committee, and it was because you had this teacher, Robert Porter, in the Bay Area.
That's very true.
And you and Ambrose Akinmusiri are the same age, and
we
more
are
or less.
We're less than a month apart.
And so you started with this same teacher, and he made both of you buy Martin committees.
Yes, he brainwashed us. No.
He was a representative for the company.
He was a representative.
No, he wasn't.
No, he wasn't. But he was very much a proponent of the horn. And not only that, but its history and all the people that played them. Actually, I remember very, very clearly in his apartment, there was a painting that he worked on. And it was the cover of Blues Mood, you know, Blue Mitchell. Holding the trumpet, and he's got like the cigarette in the left hand, but he's playing the Martin committee. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very clear, you know, there's the spit valve on the side, and it's got the very, very distinctive third valve ring. Mm-hmm. And the more he talked about it, and the more I looked around, the more people I saw, I was like, oh wow. I looked in the, you know, old photographs of Miles, and I was like, oh man, there it is. Dizzy, you know, I was like, oh, I gotta get one of these. Lee Morgan. It the lore that went along with it and in the history, we felt like we had to get them.
Thanks for listening. That was Jonathan Finlayson. Send us a note, podcast@greenleafmusic.com. We appreciate your ears.